welcome to the Heat Check Podcast. My name is Wes Goldberg. Joining me in a few minutes will be David Ramil and a special guest, Chris Barnwall, editor of At the Hive, the SB Nation blog for the Charlotte Hornets. He'll be talking to us about the Charlotte Hornets' perspective of the series, and then David and I will talk on our own about some adjustments that the Miami Heat can make. The series is tied 2-2, heading back to Miami on Wednesday for Game 5. So first is Chris Barnwall, and then it'll be me and David talking about the Heat. Here it is. Enjoy. And we're joined now by Chris Barnwall, a writer at Hardwood for Autism and editor at The Hive, a Charlotte Hornets blog at SB Nation. Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you? It feels like we just talked to each other a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it does feel like that on another podcast.
almost like there's more podcasts than this.
There are. Chris and I are the hosts of a podcast to be named later. That's actually the name of it. over at the Friendly Bounce. So check that one out at the Hardwood Proxim Basketball Network. Same network that this podcast is on. What?
We'll figure out a name one day.
Later.
Yeah, later.
All right, so Barnwell's here to talk about the Hornets' perspective. You were messaging me earlier. You said that the Heat have done everything, have prevented the Hornets from doing everything that they want to do.
Yeah, so, like, the three things that kind of define Charlotte are they don't foul, which they haven't done much of that. But the two other things that, like, really kind of define them is defensive rebounding and three-point shooting. And defensive rebounding, the Heat have just dominated them in that category. Like, we saw that in the first couple games where they killed them on the offensive boards. They've really kind of prevented Charlotte from being able to dominate the defensive boards like they usually do. And three-point shooting, they're shooting less than 30% from the field from three-point range.
And hardly shooting
from
that range.
They're shooting only 16.8 a game right now, which they are a team that in the regular season averaged well over 20.
Right.
Yeah, I think the Heat are currently leading all playoff teams in three-point percentage allowed. I think they're like somewhere around 25%, I want to say, maybe even less than that. So that's clearly been an objective of theirs during this series.
Oh, Mike, they're shooting 23%.
Okay, there
you go. According to NBA stats media.
There, that's what it was. Okay. So, yeah, not ideal for Charlotte, which is good for Miami.
It's incredible for Miami. Like, it's been the most impressive thing about them in this entire series. I've always said Eric Spoelstra is an amazing coach, but I feel like this just shows how incredible a coach he is. They took that whole math problem that everyone said was going to be a big deal going into this and just got rid of it.
Right.
Like, they forced Charlotte to be like, okay, you're going to have to beat us at our game.
So that's an interesting point, because a lot of Heat fans are upset with Eric Spoelstra because they're irrational and kind of dumb. But, you know, you're kind of pointing to this thing that, you know, the playing field wasn't exactly even, if you kind of consider that math issue. And Spoelstra's done what he can to even the playing field, and now it's just come down to making and missing shots.
It's a little more complicated than that. If you get it down to its most basic form, yeah, like, both teams are... Like, Miami's like, all right, we're going to force you to grind it out with us. And Charlotte's responded that well the last two games, but in the first two, like, they got crushed trying to do that. And it's funny because that's all Charlotte used to do, especially last year. Like, that was this team.
Right.
They grinded out games. They didn't shoot threes. They focused on isolation sets like they're doing now. And so it's kind of been weird and a little concerning at times, especially in game four when they had that awful start. It was like, oh, God, it's this again. I remember this. I don't like it.
Do you think that Charlotte is content with the way that they've been attacking the Heat's defense, or do you think that they're going to try to refine that three-point shot?
I think they're always looking to get three-pointers. I mean, one thing that's been kind of weird is, would you agree that they've missed, like, more open three-pointers than you were expecting?
Yes. Charlotte or
yeah, Charlotte. It's been weird. Like, they've had a couple open looks where they just whiffed on them, and
Kemba Walker, especially through the first three games.
Oh, Marvin Williams.
Mm-hmm. Marvin Williams is insane. He was so great this year. And just, I feel like I need to go back and rewatch some games in the series to confirm this or not. But I feel like what they're doing is they're doing so well at closing out on their shots and keeping them contested all the time that when they do get these open looks, they rush them. Because they're so worried. It's like, oh, if I don't get this up soon, they're going to, like, block it.
Well, when Charlotte was making their third quarter run, I actually felt very good seeing Marvin Williams wide open and launching a shot because I knew it was not going to fall. And sure enough, it didn't add to the, you know, the increasing lead that Charlotte was building at the time. So it's gone to that point where I'm actually comfortable seeing him wide open and taking a shot, which is completely atypical considering how he played during the regular season.
Meanwhile, Lou Alding, I'm like, oh God, he has the ball.
Sharpshooter Lou Alding, yeah.
Steph Curry Lou Alding.
Yeah, not quite anymore. Yeah, I think that's interesting because I think that the Heat have, for the most part, been frustrated for the last two games because those shots that were going in games one and two aren't going in now. The Hornets have done a lot of, you know, Steve Clifford deserves credit for the same thing you're giving credit for Eric Spoelstra. He's taking away a lot of what the Heat want to do as far as trying to get to the rim and get shots in the restricted area, especially get the ball up to Hassan Whiteside. I mean, we haven't seen an alley-oop to Hassan Whiteside in two games.
We saw that rant at the end of game two. I think it was the end of game two where Steve Clifford went on that rant about
adjustments.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because he kept the same, for the most part, the same defensive set. He changed up the starting lineup a little and made him a little bit bigger, which I think has helped him out a lot. But really what they've done is they kept daring them to shoot. They're like, look, Justice Winslow, Josh Richardson, Lou Alding are not going to beat us from three-point range the entire series. It's just not going to happen. And sure enough, eventually it stopped happening. Like, and I feel like that's kind of helped them in particular because now they don't have to – like we saw in game four, I think, Justice Winslow had so many wide-open looks and just couldn't kill the Hornets on him. And then you have Frank Kaminsky down there and Al Jefferson – and Marvin Williams and Kemba Walker, and they're all hands up right in Hassan Whiteside's face, who's not really well known for his passing, and just he looks so frustrated. And then he, or then you see him like try to force his way down low, and he hits Cody Zeller, and Cody Zeller flops like a man, like a madman.
Right, and this is what we saw in the regular season series was that the constant double on Whiteside, and that the double that comes early on Whiteside when he's near the rim. And Clifford dares the Heat to shoot, and that's why the Heat didn't fare well in that series, and why Whiteside in particular didn't have good stats in those four games. Even if you look at the personnel for Charlotte, Al Jefferson, Zeller, not really guys that match up well with Whiteside one-on-one, but when you just keep throwing bodies at him, Whiteside doesn't have a good time. And
that thigh bruise isn't helping.
The thigh bruise doesn't help. It doesn't help his bounce. It doesn't help him get up and play over the rim like he likes to. And I do want to give credit to Al Jefferson on one thing. He's preventing Whiteside from at least getting to his spot. So even if you're taking away the alley-oop, you would think Whiteside would be able, you know, as big as he is, would be able to muscle his way every once in a while into closer to the rim. But he's not getting the ball close to the rim. Jefferson's at least doing a good job trying to hold him away. Whiteside doesn't really do a good job using his lower body strength to begin with. He's kind of all arms, but... It's still, you know, Jefferson does deserve some credit for that.
It reminds me of, in games one and two, it's, sorry, I'm thinking, mixing up two thoughts here, but what you mentioned about the lower body kind of reminds me of early Dwight Howard. When early Dwight Howard, like, everyone kind of killed him for, like, his lack of a post game. It's like, well, he didn't really use his upper body much. He was really reliant on his upper body strength and his athleticism, so that's an interesting point I actually hadn't thought of, and now I'm kind of noticing some similarities. And what I really noticed those similarities is in games one and two, especially game one, one thing that I really noticed was the Hornets are a team that they like to collapse inside to help out their bigs. So they dare a lot of teams to shoot in general because they trust their perimeter guys to get back out quickly. And one thing I thought was really interesting about that was Whiteside in game one would get the ball and just he would explode and beat the help. Like, the help could not get there in time. And just he hasn't been able to do that. And I think part of that is Jefferson pushing him off ball like that because Jefferson's been moved into the starting lineup to kind of match up with Whiteside.
And one thing David and I talked about on an earlier podcast was that the Heat were starting their pick and rolls closer to the rim, which if the Hornets would help on the ball handlers, it made Whiteside's travel, you know, a lot shorter, made it, you know, and a little bit more efficient. And then if, you know, the Hornets defenders, which they usually did, would go, they would all go towards Whiteside. It already put Miami's guards in position to hit a mid-range shot because they're not necessarily good at hitting the three-point shots like they would be getting wide-open looks in that high pick-and-roll. It kind of forced Charlotte's defenders to make a tougher decision. Do you give that mid-range shot to a capable mid-range shooter like Dwayne Wade? Is a little bit harder of a decision than just always going under the screen when Wade starts the screen and roll at, you know, at the three-point line because he's not going to shoot it there.
Yeah, and I give Charlotte credit to that for they've kind of forced them to move that pick and roll out because when they were trying to get that inside, just they weren't able to do that.
Exactly. Now it's been a problem. Now that lane is all congested, it just seems that the Heat are taking contested jumper after contested jumper now, and when they were falling in games 1 and 2, they're not falling in games 3 and 4 on the road. Chris, what would be like the one thing that you would be scared of if from the Heat in game 5? What's the one thing you don't want to see?
Hassan Whiteside probably getting that defensive pick and roll back, because it was funny when he was making those complaints about flopping last night. I kind of laughed at it because I was like, wait, you're going to complain about flopping when you just got murdered in the pick and roll all night long? Which that probably had a bit to do with his thigh bruise, because he does look a little slower and not as jumpier as he was. But just, they would go straight at him in the pick and roll, and he was getting obliterated. It was not good for him defensively, which if Whiteside gets his defense back, that could mess up Charlotte's grinded out style a lot more, because it's been really interesting seeing Charlotte go back to the grinded out style they played last year and being like, okay, we can play this way too, and we've done it before, so we can do it better, and seeing Miami not handle it as well. So I guess, like I've said this entire time, the Heat just kind of sink and swim with Whiteside.
Right. I think David would agree with me. We've seen better defense from Whiteside, especially defending pick and rolls. There's that one play against Jeremy Lin under the rim. He's been great. And there's one play in game 4 against Jeremy Lin where Lin just literally ran a circle around him, and Whiteside just didn't seem like he could keep up with him, even though it was in such close proximity to the rim. It seems strange. I mean, David, do you agree that we're used to seeing a little bit more from Whiteside, even though it's been Absolutely. A common critique?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Chris talked about the injury. That's probably more than anything else. But maybe it's just the fear of picking up early foul trouble. I know he seems like he's been much more tentative, you know, in the first quarter than he should be, because he's scared of picking up an early foul call and then going to the bench and being less aggressive as a result. I don't know if that's necessarily playing on his mind constantly, but he's not been the factor that he was supposed to be or that we've seen post All-Star break. So there's definitely something going on there. If it's a combination of the injuries or the foul trouble or the fear of foul trouble, either way, he's clearly not playing at 100%, or is at least not 100% as aggressively as he should. So that's the biggest concern, I think, because, you know, like Chris pointed out, that's a concern for Charlotte. It changes the way Miami plays both offensively and defensively when he is feeling great, when he's feeling aggressive, and it certainly plays to Miami's strength. So that's a concern moving forward.
Chris, I have an unrelated question. After the Hornets went down 0-2, was Hornets Twitter freaking out as much as Heat Twitter is freaking out right now? Oh, my God.
It was so bad. It was awful. They were slamming that panic button after game 1, no less. Game 2, people
wanted... What was the biggest concern, though? Like, what were they worried about, or were they trashing?
They just felt they weren't as talented.
Really?
Yeah, they were like, this team has Wade, they got Dragic, they got Whiteside, like, we just can't keep up with them. Marvin Williams isn't showing up, Al Jefferson's awful on defense, Kemba can't shoot, Lin's been ineffective, like...
Is there a feeling, like, from the Charlotte fan base that they lack the quote-unquote superstar or anything like that, or do they see Kemba in that light?
Yeah, there's a lot of divisiveness among the fan base on how they view Kemba Walker. Some people... Right. Really do believe him to be their superstar. Others believe him just to be
a player,
a gunner, a player. Yeah. Yeah. Some people don't like him at all. They're like, they prefer Jeremy Lin to start, and that's not just Jeremy Lin fans. Actual Hornets fans have been saying that this year, which I have to disagree. But people can have that opinion.
That's very strange and wrong.
I've wanted to ask you about this series. What's with Goran Dragic? I thought he was going to be so much more of a problem than this.
Just the thing I've noticed is that the same thing that they're doing to take away Whiteside is taking away Dragic, because Dragic likes to get right at the rim. Like, he likes to finish at the rim, And by walling off the paint the way that the Hornets are, just packing the paint in general, and Whiteside not doing much to stretch the defense away from the rim, Dragic has had to end a lot of his drives, you know, 5 or 6 feet away from the rim with like a floater or a contested jumper, as opposed to right at the rim. And even if he does manage to get to the rim, it's a little bit more contested than what he's used to. So to me, that's what's at play here. I thought he did a good job in game one in particular, even though he didn't score a lot of points. I think he had like 10 assists, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
He did a nice job just controlling the game. And I think a lot of Heat fans in general just want to see like 16, 20-point games from Dragic on a regular basis. But he strikes me more of your traditional point guard as like he's going to defer probably more than what we're used to from our point guards nowadays, our Russell Westbrooks, or even Kemba Walkers now. But if the better play is for him to go at the rim, he's going to do it. But when you're playing along with like guys like Dwayne Wade and Joe Johnson and Hassan Whiteside and Chris Bosh and guys like that, level players that Dragic has never played with in his entire career, he's going to defer a little bit more. So I think Heat fans have been wanting to see Phoenix Suns, you know, third team all NBA Goran Dragic. That's just not the player he needs to be. Just like Chris Bosh didn't need to be the player he was in Toronto anymore because he's playing with more talent. I kind of went off a cliff with that, but in general,
I'd also add, like Whiteside, though, I think there's a concern about the free throw disparity. I know that we're trying to kind of shy away from that because we don't want to add fuel to that, but there seems to be, at least from the Heat fan perspective, I think it seems like Goran is not getting a lot of foul calls, and I don't know. They've questioned.
He's not really driving into people, though. He's not creating contact.
Well, I saw like early in the game yesterday, he got swiped across the arm there, and he didn't get the foul call. It's not a huge deal within the whole, you know, greater scope of the game, but it sets the trend where all of a sudden Heat fan, you know, starts to say, oh, he's not going to get the call. Like, I saw some people saying that, you know, he'd slept with every referee's wife or something along those lines. I know that's just the exaggerated form of Heat Twitter, but, I mean, there's this prevailing theme there.
We don't know that it's not true.
prove that to be wrong. Yes,
he's called the dragon because he's burning with whatever venereal disease he picked up a little bit.
Anyway. I think what we're seeing Dragic even get frustrated, especially in the last two games. Right. He's complaining to the refs a lot. He clearly feels like he's been wronged in some way. And even if it's just that one little swipe, I think you're right, David. It doesn't you know, matter in the grand scope of the 48-minute contest. But if he gets if that happens early and he gets frustrated and he stops going to the rim because he's like, well, hell, I'm never going to get this call anyway, exactly. He's going to stop doing it.
Right. You never want to point to officiating as the end-all be-all that decides the game. But it certainly shifts the player's attitude, it shifts the team's attitude. It's like, we're going to keep driving to the paint, we're going to get hacked, we're not going to get the calls, and all of a sudden it starts, you know, determining whether or not we're as aggressive as we normally would be. And I think it certainly affects him, who thrives in that because he likes getting to the rim, like you pointed out, and finishing at such a high rate.
Right.
So all of a sudden he starts going less and less. He's like, wait a minute, I'm not going to go there where Kaminsky or Jefferson is going to hack at me, you know, or even Walker in some cases. We saw Kemba Walker doing that a lot.
We did. I don't know how much of this is quote-unquote home cooking, but, you know, Walker and Lynn were getting very visibly upset with the officiating in games 1 and 2 in Miami. Right. Dragic seems very visibly upset in games 3 and 4. Interestingly enough, Dwayne Wade doesn't seem as upset as he usually gets in the regular season. I don't know how much of this is just playoff experience in general. I don't know if the Hornets, after games 1 and 2, just got over it and were like, you know what, let's just keep attacking the rim and see what happens now that we're on our home court. I don't know if maybe Dragic kind of comes off of the constant complaining that he's been doing maybe in game 5 when it goes back to Miami. But at some point, I think, you know, Dragic hasn't played that many playoff games, even though he's been in the league for a while. I think that a lot of this is just, it's the playoffs. It's a little bit more physical. Get used to it. And you've got to have the wherewithal to keep going at the rim.
I will say that I think the officiating in game 4 in particular was awful.
It was wildly inconsistent on both ends.
That was the main problem. It's like, if it would have just been the same throughout the game, like, whatever. Like, you can get away with what feels like bad officiating as long as it's, like, consistent. But it's just like, I think I remember, I was talking to Wes during it, and it was like, early in the fourth, we were like, well, apparently they're just going to allow everything to happen ever, all right. And then late in the game, it was like, you got touched and you were going to the line. just didn't make sense. And then Marvin Williams at one point took out Lou Alding and in a play that would have been illegal in three countries, and it's like, nah, play on.
It was very that was, I think that was the one that blew the gasket on Heat Twitter.
I don't blame them.
Definitely did, yeah, definitely.
But I will say, the Heat going 14-21 at the line compared to 25-30 for Charlotte, that's even worse.
They haven't hit their free throws. And Miami's not a good free throw shooting team anyway. I think the problem mainly is most other teams at this level kind of are. And that the Heat aren't getting as many, or that the other teams are getting so many more calls than the Heat are. That's at least the Heat Twitter point of view from what I can gather.
But I mean, even a 9 free throw disparity isn't a huge one.
Right.
It's just, I think it's just
the Hornets. I looked at it yesterday. The Hornets have been going to the lot, going to the paint and at the rim. They've been shooting there more often than Miami has for the series.
Yeah, and that's to be expected. They're being more aggressive getting to the rim. They're going to get more foul calls. That's just the way it works out. There's going to be a bad call here and there, and some weird stuff happening. But in general, they've been more aggressive getting to the rim.
And I hate to bring this up, but as I said it yesterday, or I mentioned or tweeted it out at one point, but Chris, maybe since you follow the team, it seems to me, and I might be dead wrong about this, but that Jeremy Lin and Kemba Walker both have the knack for throwing their head back whenever there's any contact whatsoever. And so it creates the illusion of much greater contact and draws a foul. Have you noticed that yourself as a Charlotte fan or whatever?
Lin, 100% yes.
Yeah, Lin gets touched, and he throws his head back, and it's like, oh, foul call right away. And I said,
we have a joke at the Hive, like, if Jeremy Lin gets hit in the head or face, you have to drink. Because the dude gets hit in the head and face, like, literally all the time. But, yes, he definitely does. He is in the James Harden school of, I felt a little bit of contact, I'm going to sell this.
Okay.
Kemba, not as much. He'll do it sometimes, but he has a really good relationship with the referees, as far as I can remember, where if he feels like he didn't get a call, he will yell. Right. And they'll seem to listen to him. He won't always like get them to change the way they're reffing, but he doesn't do it as much, I would say. Lindo, 100% yes. He's in James Harden school.
Okay. And Walker seems to be a little testy with Dragic. Is there any ongoing feud there that you know of, or is this just playoff intensity and just the way they're just being competitive at this point?
I think that's just playoff intensity, yeah. Although I still find it weird.
Well, there's a long-standing rivalry between UConn and Slovenia, so.
Yeah, of course. I was really expecting, like, Dragic to run a lot more than this in this series than he has, so I wonder if Kemba's kind of prevented him from doing that, and that might have Dragic frustrated.
I don't know if he's necessarily been as much of a. I think Dragic overall has just been slowed down by trying to blend in with Miami's offense over the course of the season. We've seen it.
I think Dragic, yeah, is just generally frustrated, and I think he's taking a lot of that on Kemba Walker. Just because that's his one-on-one matchup. That's been my impression, at least. I don't know how true that is, but.
What would you do to try and get Dragic to run a little more? Because I thought that was what they were going to – in the second half of game four, I really thought they were going to be like, all right, let's – especially with the lack of fast break points, I thought they were going to kick up the pace by a lot.
I think that the Dragic and Dang pick and pop thing was something that worked a lot in the regular season that they've tried to use a little bit in this series. That they really haven't done consistently. I mean, I think they are using Dang a lot in ball movement and cutting to the rim and stuff like that because he's just got a good knack for it and because they're not getting the shots at the rim that they want. I think that doing that a little bit more and maybe doing some more pick and rolls with Luol Deng and Goran Dragic could work because that's just Dragic and Deng have had a good playing relationship for the good second part of the season, right? So just trying to capitalize on that relationship that they have, I think, is the way to go with Dragic. At this point, I don't think it's going to be any drastic change. I don't think you're going to see Dragic playing off-ball any more than he's already playing off-ball. I don't think that you're going to see different lineups being used. Maybe I don't think you'll see Dragic coming off the bench or anything like that, but I think that just more of that two-man game with Dang Maybe Justice Winslow, when he's in there with Dragic, brings the ball up a little bit, or maybe initiates something at the top of the key with Dragic coming off of an off-ball screen. Maybe something like that, but that nothing crazy.
So you think that's going to stick to this grinded-out style that Charlotte's kind of forced them into in games 3 and 4, just really slow it down?
I think in general the Heat are going to try to find ways to space out the Hornets. And like I said before, the same things that are stopping Whiteside are stopping Dragic. And if they can just kind of figure out how to space out the Hornets' defense and unclog the paint, I think that's the goal. And that's going to open up things for Whiteside, Dragic, Dwayne Wade, Joe Johnson, everybody involved. If they could do it.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to see what both coaches come up with in Game 5. Like, if anything the series has done, it's given us a great head coaching matchup.
How much have you guys enjoyed this?
Oh, I love it.
Not so much. I enjoyed it more last week, I think. The shift in momentum has made it less enjoyable from my perspective.
I even loved it in Games 1 and 2 just because Spoelstra is a great coach. Clifford's a great coach. Seeing them try to figure each other out was just, it was fun to me. It was really fun to me.
Yeah, and they do actually enjoy one another. You know, they seem to have a mutual admiration for one another and what they do. So that is encouraging and good to see.
Yeah, you do like the respect between two coaches. All right, Chris, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. Chris Barnwell, find him on Twitter at Chris Barnwell. He's a writer at Harvard Proxism, a Friendly Bounce, and editor at The Hive, Hornets blog at SB Nation. Thanks for coming on, Chris.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Okay, that was our interview with Chris Barnwell, editor at The Hive. Now it's David and I talking about some adjustments that the Heat can make in Game 5. We kind of glossed over it a little bit with Chris, but, you know, I think in general it's just going to be about trying to space out the Hornets a little bit more, right?
Yeah, you're not getting much shooting at this point from our rookies who started off the series so hot, and all of a sudden they've regressed to the mean and have struggled from the perimeter, especially Justice Winslow. So you're going to need to get a little bit more out of them than just effort, which they're completely giving, but they're not spacing the floor at all, and that helps collapse the paint a lot and keeps our backcourt from getting the easier looks at the rim that they would normally need in order to score.
Yeah, I think this is a good enough time to mention the 538 article that came out this morning, kind of talking about the way that the Heat have been shooting in this series, that the Hornets defense has basically prevented them from getting the shots that they're used to getting in the regular season. The website 538 came out with this statistic called quantified shot quality, which is basically your expected effective field goal percentage. And in the regular season, the Heat were shooting were getting 50.1% of their looks. I don't even know how to describe this because I'm not a mathematician. They had an expected field goal percentage of 50.1%. We got through it, David. Don't worry.
There you go. Nice.
In games 1, 2, 3, and 4, the Hornets have kept them below that expected effective field goal percentage. Obviously, in games 1 and 2, the Heat just shot the lights out with an effective field goal percentage of 62.5% and 63%, which is plus 12 and plus 15 more percentage points than what they should have been shooting, which was like 47%, 49% from the field.
Right.
In games 3 and 4, they basically regressed to the mean. Games 3, they shot 6.7% less than what they were expected to shoot based on the looks that they were getting. And in game 4, they shot exactly even with what they were expected to shoot, 46.7% effective field goal percentage. So for those that don't know effective field goal percentage, basically it takes all the kinds of field goals, two-pointers, three-pointers, and kind of lumps it all into this effective field goal percentage. It's one of those advanced stats for our favorite terms. But this quantified shot quality is basically your expected effective field goal percentage, and it's based on the contested looks that you're getting. David and I talked about this a little bit before we started recording, that I don't know if this necessarily takes into account the fact that guys like Dwayne Wade and Hassan Whiteside and Goran Dragic like to take contested looks. Whiteside shoots a lot at the rim, and he shoots over people. And I don't, like, this doesn't necessarily take into consideration how far above the ground you are over somebody. You know, it usually takes a distance in between, like on a horizontal plane, how close the nearest defender is on to you. But And then Wade, he works on contested shots his entire career. You know, he posts up guys. He shoots falling back fadeaways. So that's not weird. The Heat typically are a team that shoots about an average percentage of contested looks. Just right. In games 1 and 2, they hit a lot of them. In games 3 and 4, they didn't. And that's basically what it's coming down to.
Right, yeah. I mean, it might seem overly simplistic, but I think as you pointed out to me, what you took from it was also that Charlotte's defense has to get some of the credit for harassing Miami into taking the shots that they might feel uncomfortable with. You know, we saw that. They took some easy shots that they missed. That's on them. These things happen. But there's also shots that they've rushed into. They haven't been able to get into their set offense as well. And you have to give credit to Charlotte's defense. I mean, I think part of the problem, and maybe I might be wrong in assuming this, is that at least from the Heat fan perspective, they saw how easily games 1 and 2 went for Miami, and you assumed that would be par for the course. You think right. Maybe game 3 was just a struggle, an aberration, and then you'd kind of pick it up in game 4. But we're seeing Charlotte kind of set the tone a little bit better and playing a style of basketball that's more familiar and comfortable with them. And I did see even some of the Heat reporters kind of questioning, you know, Miami, for all of their veteran leadership, they did not take Charlotte's response in game 3 or game 4 as well as they should have. You figure a team with as much playoff experience as Miami and with the kind of players they've had who have been through so much, that they would have said, okay, Charlotte's trying to take us off our game. Maybe they are getting the benefit of some occasional foul calls, and they would respond favorably. That wasn't the case. They kind of took the punch and said, oh, well, you know, they responded back with a nice run in the third and fourth quarter. It wasn't enough, but you still would have expected them to kind of, you know, staunch the bleeding a little bit better. When the run first happened in the second quarter, you figured that Miami would have responded a little bit better because of that veteran leadership, and they didn't. So
I think it was a 34-8 run that the Hornets went on between quarters 2 and 3. It's just tough, and I think you speak to that veteran leadership, but this team in general, they just go completely cold for 5, 6, 7 minutes at a time, and it's weird. Right. And you're just not going to be able to win a playoff series like that. I think that I don't think it's anything that needs to change drastically. I think that a lot of fans are hitting this panic button, but I don't think it's that. Even if you look at that 538 number, the difference in the field goal percentage is about 3% in expected effective field goal percentage. Like, if they just get a couple more better looks, you know, a quarter, that's enough to just kind of balance things out again. If they basically not have those 5, 6, 7 minute runs where they're just completely cold and not able to do anything on offense and the ball is sticking and it's not getting to the rim, then I think that it balances things out. I pointed this out after game 2 against Charlotte, that even though that the Heat won that game, it was based on one run that they had in the second quarter. It was why the Heat ended up winning that game, but the game was much closer than what it was expected. Nicholas Batum went down after that game. Well, in the middle of the game, right. And that's when he wasn't in the series anymore. And a lot of Heat fans were saying, well, this is it. They don't have Batum. He's arguably their best player. We've killed him in games 1 and 2. And I said, yeah, we killed him in game 1. Game 2 was much closer than what it looked like, because it was one run that they had in game in the second quarter. But quarters 1, 3, and 4 were very close. And I think the Hornets even won a couple of those quarters. So, you know, it's been just a couple of runs here and there that's made the difference in this series. And now it's tied 2-2 going back to Miami. The Heat just can't afford to go on cold runs. They have to flip the script somehow and just have their own little runs and then just manage the runs that Charlotte will inevitably have.
Right. Now, you mentioned Nick Batum, and I'm kind of kicking myself because I really meant to ask Chris about it when he was on.
Right.
And unfortunately, I don't get the chance to. It's possible and likely, I think, is what the latest reports are, that he'll be available in game 5. And I'm not so sure that that's a benefit for Charlotte. Charlotte's really found a nice comfortable rhythm. Now, you always want to have a good player available to you. And I know that he can certainly play at both style. He can play the kind of outside game that they've dominated with for most of the season. And I'm sure he could probably attack the basket and play more on the inside than what we've seen in game 3 and 4. But I'm not so sure that he plays to the strengths of games 3 and 4 for Charlotte. He might be more of a liability than anything else at this point in time. What's your take on it?
I mean, I think he might be a liability because he messes with the groove that they're in, and
Right.
And they've clearly found something good. And he's coming off of an injury. But
correct.
Even if he's available, I don't see him starting. I think that maybe if the Hornets get out the way that they want to, even if they're not winning, but if Steve Clifford sees that they're playing the way that he wants them to play, he probably doesn't even use Batum. Maybe for like a spot minute here and there, but even if he's available, I don't think that means starting. I don't even necessarily that means key part of the rotation for them. So it depends on what that all means. I don't know.
Right.
But I agree with you. I wouldn't shake things up. I wouldn't put him back in even if he's healthy right now.
Yeah. Some Charlotte fans or some, you know, Miami pundits, I guess, have said, well, you know, Batum's coming back at game five and the momentum that Charlotte has built in 3 and 4, that seems like it shifts the series back in the Hornets' favor, and I'm not so sure it necessarily does. If anything, it's more of a neutral factor. I mean, it's certainly good to have him available. It doesn't hurt them, but I don't know that it necessarily helps them as much either. So it's still going to be up to Miami to play at a high level, and it's just something that they haven't been comfortable with, you know, over the last couple of games. So, you know, I think we're going to probably talk about some of the possible adjustments that Spoelstra can make. I know for a lot of the Heat fans out there, the most critical ones, they've questioned a lot of Spoelstra's moves. And I think you and I both are very supportive of what Spoelstra's done. We've questioned what he does, but to say that he's not a good coach or doesn't have a good handle on this team and what's necessary to win is absolutely ludicrous. So I think there are probably some changes he can make, but I think he's done everything. He's gone a little off the wall. He's tried to insert players to make changes here and there. I think he's tried to initiate change as best as possible, and maybe it hasn't necessarily worked, but he's done what he's possibly could, which is, you know, what you expect out of a coach.
I mentioned when we were on with Chris about trying to space out the floor a little bit more, create more room not only for Whiteside, but also Dragic and Wade. We saw Spoelstra go with Darrell Wright early in the first half in game four. Gerald Green got minutes in the second half. Do you think Josh McRoberts sees a cameo appearance against his former team in game five?
You know, it certainly is a possibility. I mean, I think you and I were looking at that beforehand, and, you know, he's not necessarily the floor spacer that we would have liked him to be when we first signed him. When, you know, he was coming off a career year from three-point range. I think he was shooting 38%, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly capable of shooting from downtown. But we've seen him over the last years kind of been more and more hesitant. I don't know if it's due to injury or lack of practice or just confidence loss, but he's just not playing. He's not comfortable shooting that three-pointer anymore. We've seen him pass it up a lot. So the question is whether or not he's going to be able to space the floor. Does Charlotte respect McRoberts' range at this point in his career so that they'll still kind of guard him or at least hedge a little bit and stay with him on the three-point line so that maybe that will free up Dragic and others to attack the paint, because right now that congested painted area is really impacting the way Miami's offense flows. So he's certainly a better option because, you know, they put Haslam in there at the five at certain points in game four. That wasn't necessarily a good thing, although, you know, you'll always love seeing Udonis give 100% effort and do what he can. He's still very limited and immobile at this point in his career. So there aren't any other options. You know, Stoudemire is limited. He's just too slow. You don't have anybody else who can really contribute. And the best player that they could possibly insert is on the bench. His name is Chris Bosh, but it doesn't seem likely that he's going to come on board anytime soon. So given that, I think you have to play McRoberts a few minutes here and there.
I do wonder now if signing Briante Weber over maybe a more experienced big man with fresh legs might have been the wrong move.
Jarnell Stokes, maybe?
Jarnell Stokes, Carlos Boozer,
anybody
really that kind of just could have been another option. Briante Weber's not going to make... This was my issue with signing him for the playoffs. I understand getting him on the roster for the playoffs. If you view him as a long-term player on this team or even just somebody with potential, I understand getting him in on the squad right now. I get that. Not knowing how long Tyler Johnson's going to be out, I get it. But they're just so the big man thing is so shallow. I said before the series that this is a two center roster with Whiteside and Stoudemire. I don't even know if it's that, and that's a major issue when you're going against a team that plays what, four big men on a regular on two big men at the same time, four in a regular rotation.
Right. I think, well, Spencer Hawes has gotten a lot more minutes than he normally did, right?
Yeah.
I think so. And it's played towards Charlotte's strength. But you saw, like, smaller lineups from Miami, you know, having Luol Deng at the five, maybe even Justice Winslow get some minutes there.
Right. That's what I was going to get to. I mean, the way that the Heat in the Big Three era, the way that they used to answer those these big Roy Hibbert lineups and stuff like that was just keep going small and just try to small them out of the game, basically. So, like you were saying, right?
Yeah. But the problem then is that if you have Winslow play the five, he's not really spacing the floor much either. And I think, like you pointed out to me earlier, you know, if he's not connecting from long range, then you kind of lag off him a little bit, and then you sag off of him a little bit, and you know, you clog the paint again. You get onto another ball handler if they attack the paint, and so that winds up being more of a monkey wrench than anything else into their offensive plans.
Yeah, I think there's a positive in not playing Hassan Whiteside. I think obviously you need Whiteside to play well, but I don't think you can play him with Winslow. I don't even know if you could, because they keep doubling off of Winslow to cover Whiteside because they're not worried about the threat of Winslow shooting.
Right.
But in general, like, the whole idea of clogging the paint, the Hornets are doing it to stop Hassan Whiteside. And it's just not, there's just no room for anybody else to work. It's not just Whiteside likes to finish at the rim. It's basically every Heat player. So when Whiteside's off the floor, they need to do what they can. And I think if you go small with even McRoberts at the five or Luol Deng at the five, you just go super small that way and you're just creating room. If Whiteside's not on the floor, the Hornets aren't throwing that double team at Whiteside near the rim. And then that just, in virtue of itself, creates more room for Wade and Dragic and Joe Johnson to get to the rim. So that might be, obviously, I don't think it's a sustainable lineup that can play heavy minutes, but for, you know, 2 and 3 minutes here and there in a half, just if again, we don't need a drastic change. We don't need, like, to go super small lineups for 48 minutes, but if the Heat end up in that, like, 6 minute, if they're kind of going down that road where they're just cold for 6 minutes, maybe throw that lineup in there for a minute or two and just see what happens. Space out the floor, do some perimeter wing pick and roll stuff, and just kind of see what happens to just kind of unclog that offense. It might just be a little answer like that that can kind of flip things in the right direction for the Heat.
Now, it doesn't necessarily unclog the offense, but, I mean, you and I did talk about this also, whether or not it's time for Spoelstra to go back to that lineup that we saw towards the second half of the season with Amar'e Stoudemire starting, and Hassan Whiteside coming off the bench. Do you still see that as a viable possibility, or is that just more of another opportunity for you know, clogging the lane?
It's something I've kind of been going back and forth. In general, I've been a fan of Whiteside coming off the bench.
Yeah.
But given the way Stoudemire's played, I don't know. But Jeremy Lin also comes off the bench, and I like Stoudemire's chances when Lin's not on the floor, because that combination of Walker and Lin on the court together when the Hornets get to that lineup has been terrifying for Stoudemire, because he just can't defend either of them in the pick and roll situation. So if you start Stoudemire, you're at least only dealing with Walker and Courtney Lee, and Courtney Lee is not nearly the offensive threat that Jeremy Lin is, especially right, getting to the rim. So maybe there's a benefit in that way. But then you're bringing Hassan Whiteside off the bench, and that's a bench unit with Justice Winslow, which has typically been good. But that leads back to that problem where the Hornets aren't going to defend Winslow, and it's just going to be doubling Hassan Whiteside from the very, you know, the first second on the shot clock in a half-court offense, and that's just not going to bode well for Whiteside. So where Whiteside was taking advantage of second-man bench units, I don't think that would be the case against Charlotte in that situation, just given the way that they've played defense against them. I don't know. Yeah. Like I said, I don't even know if it needs to be a drastic change like that, just because it's been
right,
just these little stretches that have basically swung the games in the series.
I think that's part of, you know, the way the fans are reacting at this point is that they want something. They want something huge, something monumental. The losses have been painful because they've been such a complete turnaround from the success of the first two games. And so they're calling for Spoelstra's head, even, you know, just days after they were calling him a genius for the way he got his team to play at such a high level, etc. It's a little ludicrous, very reactionary. And I don't think that you want to give in to that. I think you have to stick with to what's worked
Right.
up to this point. You know, they're looking for change. The fans are, but I think Spoelstra's more level headed than that. Now, I think maybe if it comes down to, you know, a game six, and if Miami loses game five for some reason, and they're just, you know, this is the last chance, maybe you'll see more of a change. But, you know, before that happens, they have to play game five, and I'm convinced that Spoelstra will find a way to get the team back on track. You know, we did talk about this before the playoffs even started, how important home court advantage was for Miami. We've seen it. You know, Charlotte's played well at home, but Miami's played just as well, if not better, at their home, and they returned there on Wednesday night, so it should be a good matchup.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you told us all that it would be a 2-2 series after four games before the series started, we probably would have been like, yeah, that's probably what I would predict.
Yes.
But given how game one went, it just, the expectations, and you mentioned this earlier, just went through the roof, and there's just no way that they had the most efficient offensive game in Heat franchise history. That's not happening
right.
again.
Right.
And in game two, it almost happened again. So it was never going to get to that level. I think the other option is, or I'm sorry, I think the other thing is, I think Heat fans are looking at the adjustment that Clifford made by basically subbing out two players in his starting unit, right? Like flipping his starting lineup completely to match up mm-hmm. with the Heat. And now Heat fans say, okay, well, because that's such an obvious coaching move, right? A lot of people
right.
don't understand, like, a lot of coaching is much more subtle than that. And it's not always in your face like that. And it might not be something where Spoelstra uncovers playing Chris Bosh at center. It's not going to be that. And frankly, the series doesn't need that. So, like I said, I think Heat fans have, or just fans in general, have a way of saying the Heat need to make an adjustment. Spoelstra needs to make an adjustment here. He needs to figure this out. He needs to outcoach Clifford. But, you know, if it's Spoelstra's job is to say, okay, what exactly do I need to change? And like I've been saying, it's just those 5-6 minute stretches where they're completely useless on offense. You zero in on that. How do I fix that? It might just be a small tweak here and there. It might be playing McRoberts for a minute. It might be playing Dang at center for a minute and just switching things up and just changing the rhythm of the game a little bit to try to catch the Hornets off guard and just try to get an advantage for a minute or so. And that's
right.
enough to just kind of loosen everything up and then just keep the game chugging along, and everything should be fine that way.
I mean, he even did make that change of trying to insert Dorrell Wright. The fact that it didn't work isn't necessarily a reflection on Spoelstra so much as it is that, you know, Dorrell, had he hit the shots that he took, it would have, you know, stopped the bleeding. It would have helped impede the run that Charlotte was going on, and Spoelstra would have wound up looking like a genius. Unfortunately, he didn't hit those, and then, you know, he only played it for a few minutes anyway, just enough to go, I think, 0-for-3 or so. But either way, he's trying to make a change. He's trying to find something. And unfortunately, it didn't work out in game four, but we'll see what happens. I think the use of McRoberts is certainly a likely one, just because he's, I think, a better offensive big than anybody else you have on the roster at this point in time. You can't sign anybody else. Udonis is very limited. Chris Bosh isn't coming back. So you have to look at what happens next, and I think McRoberts is a definite possibility.
All right, we have one mailbag question from Michael at Self-Defeating on Twitter. Thanks for hitting us up, Michael. Michael asks, what should Miami do to limit Charlotte's point guards from getting to the rim nonstop? So that's a little bit of a different conversation. Now we're talking about the defensive side of the ball. We've focused a lot on offense this podcast. What do you think, David?
I have no idea. I think,
see, it's good not to be... I tweeted this yesterday. I'm just glad... Everybody's like, what about this? What about that? Tweeting at me. I'm like, look, I'm just glad that I'm not Eric Spoelstra right now.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know that he has the answers either. I mean, they're using their screener so effectively to create space for... Not necessarily space, to create just lanes for Kemba Walker and Jeremy Lin. And they're using their size and or speed to get into the painted area. And I think we've seen a combination of things. You know, we've seen Hassan Whiteside playing much more tentatively. He's also hurt. You know, as we talked about with Chris, that certainly impacted the way that Miami plays both offensively and defensively. So that's certainly a concern. I don't think that there's anything you can do there. Maybe you could do, I think you and I had talked about this before, possibly trapping a little bit earlier when they bring the ball up. You know, we saw that to great success in the Big Three era. But unfortunately, Chris Bosh isn't out there playing center. You don't have Shane Battier, rather, to make up for a lot of your defensive inefficiencies. So, you know, we're going to have to see a more aggressive, I guess, pick and roll defense from Hassan Whiteside, and that's not going to happen if he's in foul trouble or hurt. So at this point, we assume that he's going to be ready to go for game five. But the fouling situation has really thrown off his comfort level, and we've just seen him be so much less aggressive than he was in the second half of the season. But I think that's a big part of what Miami can do in order to kind of contain the, you know, Walker and Lynn from getting to the paint.
That's a good point. And I think the other thing that the Heat stumbled on late in game four was Josh Richardson on Kemba Walker.
Oh yeah.
So Kemba Walker in between the 6 minute mark and 3 minute mark of the fourth quarter scored 11 points. And from the 3 minute mark on to the end of the game, he scored 0 points.
With Richard Sutton guarding him for most of that time.
Correct. And I think that the Heat found something there. Now, Richardson had a hard time against Walker and Lynn early in that game. But I think he started to maybe get his feet under him a little bit and kind of start figuring out Walker a little bit more late in that game. He played very good defense. I don't know if it was because of the urgency of closing out that game. The Heat were within 5-6 points. I don't know what it was, but if Richardson can play like that against Walker, that means a lot. Just making it harder from Walker, starting at the three-point line where he starts at the ball all the way to the rim, if he just makes that more difficult and that these wide lanes that Lynn and Walker have been getting close up just from that, it certainly helps. So I think the combination of maybe Whiteside having a day off here, that thigh bruise continues to heal, maybe using Richardson. Richardson closed out the game over Goran Dragic because of that defense. Maybe going with Richardson, right, a little, switching up, you know, if Spoelstra switches up his rotations a little bit more to get Richardson on Walker a little bit earlier in the game. Spoelstra has been known to play with his rotations.
I thought about maybe starting him over Dragic, but that seems a little too extreme. Mm-hmm. Also, just because, I mean, you want to keep Walker. Seems to be the kind of player that, as he builds momentum, becomes more and more aggressive. You know, he started getting really fired up. Part of that is playing for the home crowd and getting a couple of easy layups, you know, getting some foul calls in his favor. But he seemed like as he was getting more and more aggressive, he just felt more comfortable and was more willing to attack the rim. And you have to give credit then to Richardson's incredible defense that he was able to limit him as much as he was in the second half. But I was wondering about maybe whether or not it was worth starting him and then you have Goran come in on the second unit. But I think that's too much of a blow psychologically. You don't want to right, shake your point guard's confidence that way by telling him, you know, you're relegated to a bench role. So yeah, I don't think that's going to work at this point.
I think that would hurt the Heat offensively as well a little too much. Richardson's a good spot-up shooter, but I think you need Dragic in there to kind of set the tone a little bit to start the game. But maybe you start with Dang on Walker, and then once Lynn comes in, you sub in Richardson, and then you can kind of move Dang and Richardson and Winslow around on those two guys. The Heat had success putting Winslow on one of those two guys, Lynn and Walker. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a matter of switching up those looks. Dragic staying out of foul trouble because he becomes a lot more passive on defense when he's in foul trouble. And he got into foul trouble the last two games. So I think that's a matter. That's something that needs to take into consideration there. So I think in general, the starters playing a little bit better, maybe switching up the rotation a little bit more to match up against Charlotte's rotations of Walker and Lynn to maybe make sure that at least one of Richardson and Winslow are in when one of those guys are in. All that kind of stuff, and then obviously Whiteside getting healthy.
Yeah.
Is going to be a big thing.
Yeah, I think if the officiating, again, you don't want to harp on it too much, but if it goes a little bit more in Miami's favor, let's say if Lynn and Walker, if that combination doesn't get the kind of frequent foul calls that they were getting in game four, they'll probably wind up being a little less aggressive on their own. So that's part of it as well. You know, it's never the all-determining factor, but it does change things on a smaller scale that impacts the greater game. So I think that's certainly something that we'll see. If the officiating goes more towards Miami's favor, it would probably make them a little less willing, a little less aggressive going towards the paint.
Sure, yeah. Anything else you want to add before we hop off of this?
No, I don't know. I'm just so conflicted. I think, you know, I know you're trying to be a lot more even keel about it than I am, but I'm trying for the benefit of you know, I don't want to incite any kind of rioting and Heat Twitter or anything like that, but it's just been difficult to watch. And I part of me is trying to prevent myself from getting too fired up over officiating and things of that sort. And I see a lot of the tweets about it, and I want to join in there and chime on these things as well. But, you know, again, you can't really just focus on the officiating. You know, the Heat made a ton of mistakes. They missed a bunch of easy layups as well as a ton of open shots. So I think if they just connect on those, we'll see a lot more of the results that were like what we saw in games one and two. So hopefully that'll be the case in game five.
Yeah, I mean, the officiating wasn't good. I mean, that we talked about it with Chris, that Luol Deng got swiped at the legs and there was nothing called. You know, Jeremy Lin slapped Luol Deng in the face at one point on a rebound and it wasn't called. I mean, the officiating wasn't great, but at the same time, the difference at the free throw line wasn't so massive that the Heat couldn't overcome it. And, you know, if the Heat aren't going on those, like, I think the main thing for the Heat, this thing that they can control, is the 5, 6, 7 minute stretches where they're just going scoreless. And if they can get rid of those, the officiating will balance itself out by the end of the series, you know. And if anything, it should go in Miami's favor because they have one more home game than Charlotte does. So you got to count on that. Hopefully the series doesn't go seven. You know, hopefully the Heat can just win the next two, and hopefully this doesn't go to a game seven. But if it does go to a game seven, it's on Miami's home court, and that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah, so we've got game three set for Wednesday at 8 p.m.
Game five, yep.
I'm sorry, game five, yeah.
Game three already happened. We can replay it, though. I'm happy to just do that.
And in Miami, that would be great. That would be ideal, I think. And then game six set for Friday?
Is that what it is?
It is. According to my NBA app here, yes, it's set for Friday. No time set for that one yet, so I guess they're waiting to see whether or not the rest of the games play out before determining that schedule. But
and we're on TNT Wednesday and Friday.
Ah, great. We don't get the NBA TV treatment?
Nope. We had some guy named Spiro last night on NBA TV.
He wasn't too bad.
He was fine. I just never heard of him before. It's kind of weird, like the NBA guys that come out of the woodwork for the playoffs. But looking forward to it. I guess we should announce now that Skip Bayless will be joining the Heat Check podcast from now on. That's his new job. That's why he's leaving ESPN.
And I'm leaving.
And David Ramil is going to Fox Sports 1.
That's right. Offering my hot takes.
Or you're going to replace Skip on First Take. Are we just doing a trade?
Oh, wow. Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to do that, to be honest with you.
So I think
I'd be a little bit more even keeled than he would, to be honest with you.
The official press release will divulge the full contents of the trade, but, you know, the gist of it is that I'm trading you for Skip Bayless and ESPN's next three first-round picks. Non-lottery protected. I got the Brooklyn Nets deal.
Nice. I don't know if I should feel insulted or honored that I got traded for Skip Bayless, but I guess I should feel honored.
It's really the three first round picks that I was looking for. Skip's just filler.
Nice.
All right. Thanks for joining me, David. Appreciate it.
You got it, Wes. Take care.
Take care. And thanks for listening to the Heat Check Podcast, a proud partner of the Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Network. You can find the Heat Check Podcast on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio. And make sure to subscribe on iTunes, rate us, review us, say nice things about us, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.